meeting of Parliament, Monday the 20th of July 2020. We continue with answers to oral questions. We commence at question number 179, and the questioner is the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, further to question 85 of 2020, can the government please provide the full names of those individual members of the Peralta, Hassan, Levy and Provasoli families who are the ultimate beneficial owners of Jib Corp Limited?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Justice, Multiculturalism, Equality and Community Affairs.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 180 to 184.
Question number 180, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, further to question 86 of 2020, can the government please advise how it was able to acquire a lease of the sixth floor of NatWest House from Jib Corp Limited, while Hassan's, namely its individual partners, still had a lease with Jib Corp Limited for the same premises that had not yet expired?
Question number 181, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, further to question 86 of 2020, can the government please advise the effective date of the lease between Jib Corp Limited and the government of Gibraltar signed by the Chief Secretary on the 19th of December 2019?
Question number 182, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, further to question 86 of 2020, can the government please provide a copy of the lease between Jib Corp Limited and the government of Gibraltar signed by the Chief Secretary on the 19th of December 2019, as this is not as yet available at the Land Registry?
Question number 183, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise why it was unable to negotiate a better rental rate from Jib Corp Limited than the £31.50 per square foot that Hassan's was previously paying for its offices?
Question number 184, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide a copy of the office premises market rental rate analysis provided by LPS or any other property specialist to the government prior to entering into the lease with Jib Corp Limited?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Justice, Multiculturalism, Equality and Community Affairs.
Mr. Speaker, in answer to question 179, these are family trusts, the terms of which are not reflected in the corporate register. The government is therefore unable to provide the information requested by the Honourable Gentleman. In answer to question 180, the lease was negotiated directly by the Director of Public Prosecutions with the landlord, as a result of which the existing lease negotiated a deed of surrender and release in relation to its legal obligations vis-à-vis the landlord. In answer to question 181, the effective date of the lease is the 19th of December. The lease is in the process of being registered. Once registered, the Honourable Gentleman can obtain a copy of the registered lease from the Land Registry at Land Property Services. A copy of the government's unregistered lease, as negotiated by the Director of Public Prosecutions and agreed by the Chief Secretary, is provided to the Honourable Gentleman now to ensure that he cannot suggest there is anything untoward in the agreement entered into by the Director of Public Prosecutions and the landlord, Jib Corp. In answer to question 183, the government considers that the rent was very successfully negotiated by the Director of Public Prosecutions. The rate was not increased and stayed at the same rate as the previous tenant had. As the Honourable Gentleman knows or should know, office rents in Gibraltar have been on the up for years. for the Director of Public Prosecutions to have been able to negotiate to keep the previously agreed rent is an indication of a very successful negotiation indeed. And finally, Mr. Speaker, in relation to the answer to question 284, the government is and was aware of other commercial premises that command much higher rental rates that are not as near the courts. This formed the basis of a rental analysis done by Land Property Services at the time. If the Honourable Gentleman believes that there were more affordable options of such office space available in the vicinity of the Supreme Court, we would be grateful if he could share the information of his own analysis with me, the Director of Public Prosecutions, and the Chief Secretary. The Director of Public Prosecutions and the Attorney General could find no such alternative options, and they did not believe such options existed, and that it would be unfair to pretend that cheaper or more affordable or attractive options existed if they do not exist at all. Finally, I want to highlight that these premises have helped the men and women of the Office of Criminal Prosecutions to start afresh and leave behind the many problems inherent in their earlier facilities. Through the Director of Public Prosecutions, they were the ones who identified these premises, negotiated the lease, and agreed it. They originated the concept of the move, and it was agreed for reasons already set out in the myriad answers to the myriad questions put on this subject in the past meetings of the House.
Mr. Speaker, I beg your indulgence as I analyse the answers. Thank you very much. Mr. Speaker, coming to the Honourable Minister's answer to question 179, she talks about family trusts. Can she indicate which particular family has a trust?
Mr. Speaker, as I recall, a company profile indicating the structure of the company with which the lease has been entered into was discussed in a previous session of the House. And if I recall, I can't remember precisely, but I seem to recollect that I provided a copy to the Honourable Gentleman.
Mr. Speaker, I certainly have not received anything from the Minister in this respect. And the previous discussion on the matter of leases, Mr. Speaker, you remember, had nothing to do with this particular lease or this particular group of companies. And therefore, I ask the question again, which family trust is she referring to?
Mr. Speaker, we are indulging the Honourable Gentleman today as we were since December, when this issue first arose. The Honourable Gentleman may not recall, but this is not the first time that we deal with questions in relation to this particular lease. The first questions were asked in the Parliament session of December, and then subsequent questions on this particular lease were asked in the Parliament of February, but because I was away on parliamentary business... Mr. Speaker, perhaps I will finish, and then the Honourable Gentleman has the opportunity to ask whatever supplementary questions he may wish. But, Mr. Speaker, I have a copy of hand, if for the avoidance of doubt, in case anyone is questioning what I am saying, I have a copy of Hansard from the Parliament session of Wednesday, the 18th of December, 2019, and the record shows that questions in relation to this particular lease were asked on that occasion. These questions, Mr. Speaker, arise from questions that were asked of me in a previous Parliament session in February, where I did not attend, Mr. Speaker, because I was on parliamentary business in the Falkland Islands, and the opposite side were given the option of a written answer or carrying the questions forward on an oral basis. And these particular questions have been carried forward, Mr. Speaker. That is, by the by, the Honourable Gentleman is asking me for information that is a matter of public record. There is a copy of the company profile in relation to the structure of the parties in relation to the lease. That is a matter of public record. We have discussed that already. And in relation to his further question, the answer remains, Mr. Speaker, as per my answer to 179. This is in relation to a family trust, Mr. Speaker. But for clarity, the corporate structure is available through a company profile and is a matter of public record.
Mr. Speaker, she still has not answered my question. Which family trust? Can she not at least tell me that? I have the company profiles in front of me, and I know which entity ends up in a law firm. Can she at least tell me which family trusts are involved, or does she not know? Mr. Speaker, I've asked a simple question. Yes, we ventilated the subject before. These questions are further to the questions in December. She was not here in February. We all know that. Her history lesson of what happened since February, we all understand. I've come to this House, Mr. Speaker, with a specific question. I just like an answer. Now, if she just doesn't want to give me the answer, fine, I will accept that. But to say it's a family trust is not good enough. I just want to know which family trust, or trusts in plural. Does she have the information with her? Can she advise the House? Maybe the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister will have the information with him. But I think, Mr. Speaker, I'm entitled to an answer.
Mr. Speaker, I appreciate that I have answered a number of questions on this subject together. In order to assist the Honourable Gentleman opposite, I shall repeat my answer to question 179. The answer, Mr. Speaker, is these are family trusts, the terms of which are not reflected in the corporate register. The government is therefore unable to provide the information requested by the Honourable Gentleman. Mr. Speaker, question asked, question answered.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I have the profiles in front of me. Two entities, one of which have named shareholders, these are obviously not trusts. Another one that has, and I'm going to say it now in Parliament since the Honourable Lady has not volunteered the information. And the other one, Mr. Speaker, ends up in Line Holdings Limited as one shareholder, and Line Nominees Limited as the other shareholder. Now, can she at least tell me the names of the trusts that hold those shares? Or does she not have the information? I know from one side of the organisation, the Peralta family, that is fully disclosed at Companies House. The other side is not disclosed. But does she have the information or not?
Mr. Speaker, the question has been asked. The question has been answered. Further information in relation to what is not on the corporate register is not something that I have on me, Mr. Speaker, and it's not further information that I am able to provide.
Mr. Speaker, I thought my question to Parliament was pretty clear, and they were able in the last session to identify those individual members of the families, right? But now they cannot identify the family trusts. Could the Honourable Lady at least do me the favour of going back and finding out which of those families are the trusts? Right, that's all I would ask for, Mr. Speaker. Would the Honourable Minister be willing to do that for me?
Mr. Speaker, we were here in December where a question was asked. The Honourable Gentleman himself says that I informed him the names of the family members that were referred to in that question. What else does the Honourable Gentleman want? We've already, these are questions that are being asked today and have had an answer, are further questions to previous questions which already have an answer, and in fact answers to which he already knows. Mr. Speaker, we're going round in circles answering the same question to the same, answering the same question that we have already answered, Mr. Speaker. There are a number of questions in relation to the same subject matter on this occasion, in the same way that we've had in previous Parliament sessions, Mr. Speaker. I'm afraid that we're just going round and round in circles.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Lady obviously has no intention of answering my question. Now, we were going around in circles, Mr. Speaker. You would have disallowed my question in the first place, because this is further to a question. No, no. This is further to my question. No, no, I'm on my feet. But if she wants to raise a point of order, I will say.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker, because the Honourable Gentleman is trying to insinuate that I'm not going to answer the question. Mr. Speaker, what I have said on numerous occasions is that I've already provided the Honourable Gentleman with the answer. I've provided him with the answer to today's question. I have provided him with information in relation to previous questions. It's the same information in relation to the same lease. The information is not going to change. He has a substantial amount of information, Mr. Speaker, already. It's just not right for the Honourable Gentleman to say that I'm not answering his question. I have answered.
Speaker, my own point of order.
Yeah, okay, let's listen to
your
point.
She's not answering my questions.
The point here is that she's answered the question. Well, the Honourable Member's asked the question, and the Honourable Minister has answered the question. Now, if that is the position that she has stated, then you have to accept what the Minister has said. I know, but you have to. We just can't go on and on talking about whether she or the Honourable Minister has or hasn't. She has said in her answer that she's answered the question. You, I understand and appreciate that you may not be happy with the answer, but she has stated that she has given the answer to the question. Now, I'll allow you just one final supplementary. Thank you.
Mr. Speaker, my own point of order. If the Minister alleges that she's given me an answer and I haven't had information, she said she gave me information about the trust. I haven't had that information given to me. She then says that she's giving us the answer, but she hasn't answered my question specifically. Now, either she wants to give us the information or not, but, Mr. Speaker, I cannot be forced to accept what she says just because she says it.
By the same token, I can't force the Minister to answer a question which you allege has not been...
She can't allege, she has answered.
So, we'll allow the Minister to respond and then we'll move on. Thank you.
Mr. Speaker, thank you for your indulgence. Before I move on with the further answer to the supplementary, perhaps I could remind the Honourable Gentleman opposite of a little lesson of etiquette in this House, and where we refer to each other as honourable members. Mr. Speaker, certainly on this side of the House, we always try to be very courteous and respectful to the members opposite, particularly in how we address them. But in relation to the substantive question or supplementary question, perhaps I could remind the Honourable Gentleman of my answer to question 85. That is what I was alluding to earlier, Mr. Speaker. Question 85 of 2020 by the Honourable Gentleman, no one else, Mr. Speaker, asked who the landlord and the beneficial owners, if a corporate entity, to the premises were. And at that time, Mr. Speaker, the answer was very clear. The answer, and I will read the text of Hansard, Mr. Speaker, was, Mr. Speaker, the landlord is Jib Corp Limited. The beneficial owners are the Peralta family, the Hassan family, the Levy family, and the Provasoli family through their respective holding companies. Mr. Speaker, that is from Hansard. We have already been down the road of asking this question and very much answering this question.
Mr. Speaker, I'll move on since it's obviously impossible to extract any information from the Honourable Lady. But, Mr. Speaker, can the Minister provide us with the qualifications of the Director of Public Prosecutions in terms of negotiating leases and property? I mean, is he a qualified estate agent? What qualifications does he have in respect to property? Because she's telling us, Mr. Speaker. She's telling us. What was that? Oh, good way. What was it?
Mr. Speaker, if they were able to get up and suggest that the Director of Public Prosecutions not to have the ability to negotiate a document, a contract, is absolutely absurd. And what I said to the Honourable Member is that the DPP, in my view, has very much more experience than he does.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Minister for his contribution, but if you listen carefully, I wasn't talking about his capacity to negotiate or examine a legal document. I wanted to know what experience does the Director of Public Prosecution have in terms of property and property prices and negotiation of property rentals. Now, if you're going to tell me that everybody who is a lawyer is an expert in property negotiation, well, I think that's a bit of a generalization. And when you talk about my experience doesn't come into it. I would not dream of negotiating a lease personally without taking independent advice on property prices. So, Mr. Speaker, when the Minister says that the Director of Public Prosecutions directly in himself negotiated and identified these premises, I just want to know what is his experience, what is his qualification in property.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member seems to have this ability not to listen to answers when they're given to him, because the Director of Public Prosecutions is the head of the department for whom the officers were and led the negotiations in respect to these units. But of course he does so on the benefit of advice, which is what we do every day of the week in whatever we're doing. We take the benefit of advice and we negotiate. And in my view, as I said earlier, the DPP is more than able to negotiate the terms of a contract in respect of property on the basis of the property advice that he has and his own ability as a senior officer in government to do this particular function.
Mr. Speaker, can the government then advise whether it is their policy the heads of the department are free to negotiate leases for their own office space?
Mr. Speaker, what's that got to do with anything we said in response to our answer? Who said anything about a policy? You've asked a question, Mr. Speaker, as to whether the DPP negotiated the contract. He was told he did on the benefit of advice, and that's it. Who's talking about policy or change of policy?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the Minister mentions on the basis of advice. Could he provide a copy of that advice or explain where that advice came from? And before he shakes his head and says, I haven't heard the answer to the question, the Minister, the Honourable Lady, did refer to LPS and higher valuations, etc., etc. But of course, there are lower valuations and other properties. But is the Minister suggesting then that the DPP acted purely on advice from LPS and other possibly unidentified persons?
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member needs to listen to the answers because the Honourable Lady has already given specific details of why that particular property was suitable, why there were none others close to the courts. I heard the answer. I don't understand why he didn't hear the answer. Bearing in mind, he asked the question. The answer has been given in detail as to why that particular property was suited best and why there were no other competitive prices or cheaper prices within the area that the DPP requested. Therefore, if the Honourable Member cares to listen to the very answers of his questions, I think we'll be able to get through business a lot quicker and more efficiently, sir.
Mr. Speaker, I still haven't heard who the advisor was.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman may not have heard because it seems that he asks questions but doesn't seem to listen to want to understand. It seems that he asks questions just to ask further questions and clearly just asking questions for the sake of it. Mr. Speaker, what I said in my answer to the question, and anyone with a little bit of economic common sense would understand, is that the people negotiating this contract, a commercial contract, were able to agree the same terms as the original lease, Mr. Speaker. So if I break it down in very simple language for the Honourable Gentleman to understand, and I thought he was a man of figures, I am a woman of words, but I thought that he was a man of numbers, but I will explain numbers for him. Mr. Speaker, if someone in the past negotiates a lease, terms of leases, value of commercial leases, tend to go up. But in this occasion, Mr. Speaker, when this agreement was entered into, as I said in the answer to the question, if he was listening, the terms, the commercial terms of this agreement is the same as the old terms, Mr. Speaker. So to anyone who understands anything about the commercial world, that in itself is a success. So that's the first point. Now, in relation to the second point, Mr. Speaker, as I said, having discussed the matter with LPS, and I discussed the matter with LPS subsequent to the agreement being entered into, because this had nothing to do with me, because this happened before my time as the Minister for Justice, but nevertheless, for the purposes of the Parliament questions on the same topic that have been asked in December, and have been asked in January, and have been asked in February, and still here we are on the same topic. Mr. Speaker, I asked for quotes, generally, of a commercial lease in the area. And quotes that I have been given are much higher than the value of this commercial agreement, Mr. Speaker, much higher. And I invite the Honourable Gentleman, if he thinks that this is not good value for money, to present to me a commercial premises close to the courts of Gibraltar that can house 18 offices for a rent that is cheaper than this one and that is suitable for purpose.
Mr. Speaker, I'll give her an idea for free, and that is Town Range, St. Mary's School, I think, is going to be moved. Perfect premises there for law officers, if the government had any imagination or forward planning before entering into commercial agreements. But, Mr. Speaker, it's not my job to tell the government how to do her job. It's my job to...
Well,
she asked me. She invited me to give her suggestions.
Focus on the important issues here and let's not digress. Please, if you have a...
Just one final supplementary. In relation to... by the way, I'm grateful for the copy of the lease and I thank the Minister for that. Just one final supplementary, Mr. Speaker. In terms of the unexpired portion of the lease, which is in relation to question 180... How was it that it came to pass that the DPC, or Director of Public Prosecutions, was able to negotiate for the landlord to effectively terminate the existing lease so that, the DPP could effectively take possession of the premises early?
Mr. Speaker, it was, as I would imagine, a negotiation and part of the negotiation. Quite, I think, standard practice for someone who is a skillful negotiator.
Next question.
Question number 430, the Honourable D.A. Feetham.
Mr. Speaker, in the light of the answer to question W75 of 2020, has the government abandoned its previous plans for a halfway house for men?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Justice, Multiculturalism and Community Affairs.
Mr. Speaker, support for men is being provided in a different way.
Mr. Speaker, does that mean that the government has abandoned its plans for a halfway house for men?
No, Mr. Speaker, it means that men will be helped in a different way. Mr. Speaker, initially, when I looked at this at the very, very beginning, my initial view was to have one single building only in relation to men. And when we're talking of a halfway house, what we were looking at was mirroring the arrangements that we have for women in need, for example, which predominantly is supposed to provide shelter for women who are victims of domestic abuse, but will also extend its services to women who may be homeless in exceptional circumstances and for limited periods of time. And we were looking at mirroring this in terms of structure and in terms of building and in terms of management. But after advice and a lot of consultation, particularly with people who run Women in Need and looking at the various implications, we thought about providing the need for men who are homeless or victims of domestic abuse and need shelter in a different way. The predominant objective, Mr. Speaker, was ensuring that we provide for these gentlemen. So instead of having a building which is similar to Claire Burrell House, for example, what we've done instead is had various arrangements to provide housing, shelter, for men who find themselves genuinely homeless or men who need a roof over their heads because they are victims of domestic abuse and need to leave their premises. What we've been doing over the years, Mr. Speaker, is identifying premises. They are, a lot of these premises are actually managed by the staff at Women in Need for Men, and we have quite a number of these homes available, and we have other premises available as well, and these are managed by another government department and managed by the hostels. So that's how we are providing for men at the moment, and that was as a result of a lot of thought and a lot of consultation. So whereas we may not have one building which is a halfway house for men, we have many buildings which meet the same purpose. So the Honourable Gentleman can rest assured that men are being assisted. That's number one. But you may be aware, Mr. Speaker, I was looking at, in my time as Minister of Housing, I was looking at progressing this even further, possibly under the auspices of the Housing Department. And you may have heard the Honourable Gentleman, the Minister for Housing, announced last week of a shelter for homeless people that he has in his plans. So this is something that would also alleviate and meet this need, and the Minister and I will be working very closely together to make sure that any needs that are required in the community are met. So the Honourable Gentleman can rest assured.
Can the Honourable Lady inform the House how many properties have been allocated for the scheme that she's just announced to Parliament? In other words, for people that are in need of a halfway house, and the government's no longer building those, how many properties have been set aside for that purpose?
Mr. Speaker, the scheme currently in place has already assisted 11 gentlemen, some of them alone and some of them with their families. I'm confident that the scheme as it is working well and meets the criteria that we would have implemented had we done it in the way that we first envisaged it, but possibly in this way, I would dare say it's easier to manage and probably also manage in a more cost-effective way.
How many properties have been set aside for this scheme?
I have 11 flats, Mr. Speaker, for that.
So there are 11 flats, and I thought that the Honourable Lady said that the government has assisted 11 people, or 11 families. How many are currently vacant?
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman is right. I am confident that we have 11 flats from the schedule that I have here. It may be that we have assisted more than 11 families, because I know that more than one family have been in these flats, but it's not reflected in the schedule. So for in order to give an assurance, I can certainly say that there have been 11 families because there are 11 flats, but because I know that more than one family has been in more than one flat before they've been rehoused by housing, then I know that there are more, but I can't give the figure as to the additional ones. Mr. Speaker, in addition to that, recently and over the last few years, some of the procedures at the Housing Department have also been worked on in order to be able to identify people who are in desperate, urgent need of housing and who are eligible and who apply and who meet all the necessary criteria, and in which case their cases are expedited. Mr. Speaker, you may also be aware that I embarked on a consultation process on parental alienation towards the end of last year to identify issues that specifically may impact certain sectors of our community, and particularly men in particular in relation to marriage breakdown, and housing has been identified as something that they need. I know that now as a result of the consultation process, but I was certainly very much aware of it before the consultation process. In fact, that was one of the motivations for having such a thorough consultation process. So it's something that's very much on the government's radar.
Mr. Speaker, I apologise to insist, but the Honourable Lady has not provided me with an answer to the supplementary. How many vacant properties does the government have at the current moment under the scheme, vacant properties? And if I may ask another supplementary so that the Honourable, so we don't have to... the other supplementary is, what does somebody in a situation that is homeless have to do in order to apply to be housed under... this particular scheme, and can she also provide the criteria that would be applied to determine whether somebody is successful or not?
Mr. Speaker, working in collaboration with the Housing Department in this regard, which was the practice in the past, obviously it was easier before because it was the same minister, but that doesn't mean that because there is a different minister with responsibility for housing that we don't work very, very closely indeed. These flats that we identify and are managed by women in need, Mr. Speaker, for men, are flats that become vacant. Are Gibraltar government rental tenancies that become vacant, and the tenancy is passed on to women in need for them to manage for the purpose of assisting these individuals. So as and when we identify flats, they are passed on. In addition to that, Mr. Speaker, the Housing Department will also help individuals for as long as they meet the eligibility criteria for housing, which is a requirement for people to be housed by women in need in any event. I'm aware that there are potentially 4 further flats available for this purpose. But in any event, Mr. Speaker, someone who genuinely finds himself in a situation of homelessness and desperation can apply for housing to the Housing Department in the normal way. And there is now a procedure to assist people, to assist in finding them suitable accommodation in their own right. This is sometimes used as a halfway measure if a property cannot be identified. But because the mechanisms over the last few years at housing have been improved, then going down that route is usually successful for as long as the applicant is entitled to apply.
So, Mr. Speaker, as I understand it, because I wouldn't want the Honourable Lady... I wouldn't want to go away from this Parliament getting the wrong impression. Can she confirm that at the moment there are 4 vacant flats under the scheme? That's what I'm asking. How many vacant flats at the moment are there under the scheme? Because the answer that she's given me could be interpreted, well, there are a number of flats, but we also have an additional 4 flats that are also coming in. What I'm asking is, how many vacant flats are there at the present moment in time? And the reason why I'm asking that is to assess whether the supply is sufficient to cope with demand, and make further assessment and perhaps even ask further questions in the future. That's one. And secondly, I'm still unclear as to where an application for emergency housing under the scheme that the Honourable Lady has outlined to Parliament, where that is made. Is it made to the Housing Minister or the Principal Housing Officer or the Housing Manager, or is it made to those that manage these flats, which the Honourable Lady said was women in need? And I'd like to clarification in relation to that, please.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, these flats, 11 flats, 11 existing flats are managed either by women in need or by the hostel. but these are not flats within the hostel, but rather flats elsewhere and managed by the hostel manager. But certainly, in terms of the latter, managed by the government. In addition to the vacant flats that I have referred to, these are four vacant flats that exist over and above this quota that has been allocated to women in need and the hostel for this purpose. In relation to those four vacant flats, at the moment, those flats belong to the housing department. Anybody who is eligible for government housing, and that is a prerequisite for an allocation to these flats, whether it's through the housing procedure as normal or whether you want to apply through Women in Need, you still have to be eligible for government housing in any event. That's a precursor for both. Now, depending on the competing demands, so in the first instance, as the Honourable Gentleman is asking, for as long as the person is an entitled applicant, in the first instance, they should apply to the housing department. If the person meets the criteria and is genuinely a homeless case and meets all the criteria, then the housing department will allocate them that tenancy as a normal tenancy, which they would be entitled to. In the case that it's not, and also given the location of the flat, it may be a consideration by the government to allocate the tenancy to women in need. The women in need would then grant a license to the individual for a short term while their turn on the housing list arises. But the first point of call would be the housing department for as long as the person is eligible and meets all the criteria required.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the Minister for her information, and that I recognize that this question by my honourable friend to my right comes as a result of a question that I had put to her, which then got answered by written format. And her answer was that, because I had asked about the 2015 manifesto commitment for a halfway house, and the Honourable Lady actually correctly said that they don't need to honour the 2015 and that we have a new legislature, which is indeed correct. But the fact of the matter is, and we are talking about new plans and proposals, but that the government or the party campaigning at the 2015 election had a plan for men in need, effectively. And that plan has not been delivered between 2015 to 2019 or 2019 to date. So would the Honourable Lady acknowledge that to date, since that commitment that they came to in 2015, men in need have not been catered for or helped in that way, and that we are still waiting for this to materialise?
Excuse me, I think the answer has already been given as to why there's been a change of plan. I think you're asking a question, the Honourable Member is asking a question which has already been answered. Now, if the Honourable Lady wishes to go over that, I'm quite happy to listen.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, because I do find the latest supplementary quite regrettable, given that I have explained at length that the outcome is the same, we just have a different methodology. This methodology was thought to be, felt to be, quicker, faster, more appropriate to help people, and better value for money. Just because there is not, as I said earlier in relation to previous supplementary questions, a building that is called Men in Need, doesn't mean that the needs of homeless men have not been met since 2011. They have very much been met, and I don't know if the Honourable Lady heard me explain that we have identified flats for them, and indeed during this time have helped a lot of men, whether with their families or by themselves.
Can I ask a question about the criteria? Because of course, you could have a situation whereby someone says, "Well, I am homeless because my mother and my father don't want me to live there in their house, and therefore," and we've all heard them because they come to my surgeries. They've probably gone to the Honourable. Probably all the Honourable Ministers on that side of the House. And the Honourable Lady basically said, well, if somebody is genuinely homeless, then the Housing Department steps in and gives them a tenancy. How do you distinguish between a situation whereby the Housing Department gives them a tenancy, or the housing department decides that actually what we need really is the sort of halfway house flat sort of scheme, if I can call it that. I mean, how do you decide which one is what? Because there is the propensity here, of course, for people to also skip the housing queue if they were to be allocated a tenancy on the basis that they're homeless because their father and their mother have basically said, well, I don't want you to live here, for example.
Mr. Speaker, the idea for the men's refuge, when it was initially referred to in the first manifesto, as the Honourable Lady said, was for it to be a shelter for men in need in the same way as women in need, for people who are victims of domestic abuse, so that there was no inequality in terms of men and women. But invariably, as happens in these situations, it's extended to how you help people, and not everybody who is in either of these flats, whether it's for the men or for the women, are all victims of domestic abuse. Now, in relation to who is eligible for these properties, the baseline, really, the starting point, is people who are victims of domestic abuse. Now, if we want to extend it further, it will depend on the circumstances. But it doesn't mean that just because had we had a building which was a halfway house for men, that someone who finds themselves in a situation as described by the Honourable Member would have been accommodated there either. Because, as the Honourable Gentleman rightly says, there are circumstances where everybody comes to a clinic, whether it's his clinic, my clinic, our clinic, who may purport to be homeless because they don't want to live with their parents, or because they say that their parents don't want them to live there. But, Mr. Speaker, in most cases, where if somebody is an occupier in a government tenancy, first of all, for us to have that as a starting point, everybody would have to go through the process of removing someone from the government tenancy in the first place, because it's not as easy, as the Honourable Gentleman will know, for parents to say, oh, I don't want my child to live here anymore, and kick them out on the street. It will be part of their contract, part of their tenancy, because their children will, in most cases, be registered as occupiers of the premises, and they will have to go through formal procedures in order to remove them from occupiers, because they, as occupiers, because they will have certain rights. And if it were the case where someone genuinely wants to kick somebody out for a genuine reason, then I have no doubt that the housing department will consider such a case appropriately. But in relation to the example that the Honourable Gentleman has mentioned, that is how it would be dealt with in the normal course of things.
Hey, Mr. Speaker, because I think it's an important topic for a lot of people out there that face a situation that they're looking for, both those who are on the housing waiting list and those that are in an emergency situation, because of course one impacts on the other. And that brings me to my final supplementary. Will the government consider publishing transparent guidelines and criteria for how these flats are allocated? Because there is the propensity for potentially for this to be questioned, and Gibraltar's a very small community, and of course you may have officials that may allocate for what they consider to be good reason, but then that starts the chitter chatter outside about whether in fact this is a political decision that's been taken by the minister in order to help somebody that he wants to help. And indeed, in a democracy, I'm not saying that it's happening, but in a democracy, we need to institute robust structures in order to prevent that sort of thing happening. And publishing criteria so that everybody knows where they stand in terms of an application of this nature would, in my respectful view, be a step forward. I wonder whether that is something that the Minister would consider.
Mr. Speaker, I thank him for the lesson in transparency. I can assure him that we don't need it. Mr. Speaker, the procedures, if entry were to be through women in need, are very clear. Procedures for entry through the housing department are very clear. But because this is all part of a bigger picture, Mr. Speaker, there are changes that are in the pipeline, and there are documents, which in fact I already have in draft, which will be published and will, I think, be of greater assistance to people who may have questions, and will certainly be a very helpful guidance for anyone who may be interested in the matter. But you can rest assured that anyone who makes an application will be given a copy of the application, the process, and the process will be explained and an answer will be given to them before he starts, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman, starts making any side allegations.
Next question. Question number 431, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan Naon.
On the basis that the Beat COVID app does not process personal information and is therefore outside scope of the General Data Protection Regulation, the Contact Tracing Bureau, by contrast, does process personal data, that is, information about individuals or from which they can be identified. Given that this is a relatively new type of processing brought about by the COVID-19, can the government confirm whether a specific privacy notice or policy has been issued which applies to the processing undertaken by the Contact Tracing Bureau?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Justice, Multiculturalism, Equality and Community Affairs.
Mr. Speaker, yes. The Contact Tracing Bureau, in conjunction with the government's data protection officer, has carried out a thorough data impact protection assessment in accordance with GDPR. A privacy notice is available on the public health website.
Mr. Speaker, does the Contact Tracing Bureau share data with third parties?
No, Mr. Speaker, the Contact Tracing Bureau will only trigger this information in the event of a positive case, in which case they will need to contact either the people that the positive individual says that they've been in contact with, or the establishment that they may have visited in the case of the contact tracing process. But it's about the only third party that would know the information would be anybody who they may contact to tell them that they may have been in contact with someone who's positive, but at no point will they be told who the individual who is positive may be. That information is not shared. So that is the only way that the information leaves the Contact Tracing Bureau in the event that only someone is tested and gives us a positive result.
Mr. Speaker, I was asking more towards finding out whether no data actually leaves us or the European Union. Technically, for example, we could be hosting information on a cloud that could be in Japan or anywhere else, and this is why I was asking whether any data is shared with third parties from the point of view of any technological hub that could be holding this data.
No, Mr. Speaker, because the Contact Tracing Bureau itself doesn't actually hold this data. The Contact Tracing Bureau will only obtain the data once the contact tracing is triggered, and that is triggered through a positive result. This is the Contact Tracing Bureau. It should not be confused with the Contact Tracing app. That certainly does not hold any data whatsoever, and I think that that is clearly understood by everyone. The Contact Tracing Bureau is essentially now a department where that is tasked with contacting people who may have come into contact with anyone who has tested positive, and the person, if I can explain the procedure, someone tests positive, so they receive a phone call, personal phone call, from someone who is working in the Contact Tracing Bureau, and they'll say, look, you've been swabbed today, you have a positive result, please tell us where you've been for a particular period of time, and let us know who you think you may have been in contact with, so that we can call them and tell them that they're infected. So it's not until that point that the people at the Contact Tracing Bureau receive that information, and that information will then go on to third parties and stop there.
Mr. Mr. Speaker, the question that I submitted was dated on the 19th of June, and from what I can see, the privacy policy was published on the 23rd of June, but the contact tracing bureau was live before that date. Does this mean that the privacy policy was published after the bureau went live?
It may be that it was uploaded before the contact tracing bureau or after the contact tracing bureau went live, but it was most certainly a document that was very much worked on before the contact tracing bureau was established. In any event, I don't think that there were any positive cases within the intervening period, so there was no data actually kept.
The Honourable Deputy Chief Minister.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that this House do now adjourn to Monday, the 27th of July at 3:30 p.m.
I now propose the question, which is that this House do now adjourn to Monday, the 27th of July at 3:30 p.m. I now put the question, which is that this House do now adjourn to Monday, the 27th of July at 3:30 p.m. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Passed. The House will now adjourn to Monday, the 27th of July at 3:30 p.m.